Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
There are some new, harsher drug penalties in the state of Florida. Some experts are questioning whether they're effective, but some Florida officials have no doubt they'll work.
Heck yeah, it will. It's going to get these monsters off the streets for 3 years while we can clean this problem up throughout our country.
Also this week, that opioid crisis is also leaving a growing number of damaged children in its wake.
Our area never had more than one or two parents die a year of overdose. We've already had 23 parents die this year.
We'll also find out why there are some reservations about a new Florida law supposed to help human trafficking victims and learn about the debate over whether social media sites like Facebook can get more people involved in positive politics. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. States across the country are struggling to hold off a rising tide of opioid abuse, and Florida's no exception. But Nick Evans reports the return of harsh penalties for possession, a hallmark of the war on drugs, is frustrating a broad spectrum of advocates and officials.
This month, Attorney General Jeff Sessions spoke at the 30th International DARE, or Drug Abuse Resistance Education Conference, in Texas.
So now some people today say that the solution to the problem of drug abuse is to be more accepting of the problem.
Sessions took shots at the enforcement policy under former President Barack Obama's Justice Department, where federal prosecutors were encouraged to avoid charges with minimum mandatory sentences for nonviolent offenders.
They say the answer is always treatment. Only treatment do they suggest. They say don't talk about enforcement. Gosh, we can't have prosecutions. They say don't say no to me. Don't tell me what I can't do. So that's the kind of mentality. But I'm going to tell you, that was a mentality in the late 1970s and early 1980s, too.
Sessions is pushing a return to the tough-on-crime approach championed during the war on drugs. And his words caught the attention of a former Florida lawmaker.
I am either famously or infamously known as a member of Congress who got busted purchasing drugs.
This is Republican Trey Radel. His resignation came after an undercover officer arrested him in 2014 trying to buy cocaine. Radel believes Republicans in particular need to move away from the lock-them-up approach Sessions is trumpeting. He says housing often nonviolent offenders is expensive. Felony convictions follow offenders for years, and they fall harder on minority communities.
Whether you're fiscal conservative and watching our money get thrown out the window with no solutions whatsoever, or if you're a social conservative, the way that it breaks up families and renders really good people obsolete and even more of a drain on society.
But recently, Governor Rick Scott held a ceremony celebrating his signature of a new controlled substances bill, the state's latest effort to address opioid abuse.
One of the most important things what this bill does, it hopefully gets the drug dealers off the street. The penalties are going to be a lot worse.
The measure imposes mandatory minimum penalties for fentanyl and its derivatives. It's a provision state senators stripped out but then added back in at the last minute. Attorney General Pam Bondi lobbied hard for the penalty, and she applauds the move.
It's much needed. And will a 3-year minimum mandatory make a difference? Heck yeah, it will. It's going to get these monsters off the streets for 3 years while we can clean this problem up throughout our country.
Prior to this, Florida had been moving away from mandatory minimum sentences. Bondi argues no ordinary addict will wind up with the 4 grams necessary to qualify as a trafficking amount, but some Republican lawmakers are skeptical. St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis points out the measure includes the weight of mixtures, so that a grain or two of fentanyl in a bag of some other powder would be calculated as if the entire amount is pure fentanyl. And while Governor Scott and Attorney General Bondi tout $27 million in new federal funding to fight opioid abuse, Grace Point Wellness CEO Joe Rutherford questions the state's commitment to substance abuse treatment.
Of course, Florida is at the bottom of all 50 states in mental health and substance abuse funding per capita. What we have found, though, is that the budget that was approved that went in effect July 1 of this year, Florida actually reduced by an additional $11 billion what is spent on mental health and substance abuse funding. They used the $27 million sort of as an offset.
Since Scott and Bondi took office, they've worked diligently to shutter the pill mills responsible for an explosion in prescription opioid abuse. But many people have argued the state didn't do enough to help addicts. A 2014 study from the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry and a 2015 study in the New England Journal of Medicine indicate as prescription drugs dried up, abuse of street drugs like heroin grew. A Florida Medical Examiner's report shows the number of deaths caused by heroin in the first half of 2016 jumped nearly 27% compared to the same period the year before, a total of 406 fatalities. The number of deaths tied to fentanyl and its analogs is more than double that. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Manatee and Sarasota counties have seen overdose deaths from drugs like heroin and fentanyl spike in the past few years. And at the same time, the number of children being removed from their homes and placed into foster care has increased dramatically. As Stephanie Colombini from member station WUSF in Tampa reports, there's a connection there.
When you step inside Elizabeth and Kate Dumbaugh's Sarasota home, you find a neat, elegant living room and don't hear much besides the quiet hum of the air conditioner. You wouldn't know six kids under the age of nine were living there. That is until you walk down the hall, past a bedroom door covered in colorful illustrations and I love you mommy notes, and into the playroom where a couple of toddlers are keeping busy. There's a mini kitchen, a crib for a doll, a sprawling train set, and arguably the largest teddy bear ever made.
This is cute.
That's Brina Slater, vice president of the Safe Children Coalition, which has overseen the foster care system in Manatee, Sarasota, and DeSoto counties for about 20 years. Slater says for most of that time, child welfare agents would bring in 30 to 40 kids a month, and about half would go into foster care. But now,
we've had a 120% increase in the last 3 years.
The coalition knows substance abuse tops the list of reasons cited for child removal this year. Now, substance abuse can mean anything, marijuana, alcohol, but Slater says she's seen a clear connection with the rise in opioid use.
Our area never had more than one or two parents die a year of overdose. We've already had 23 parents die this year.
With all the statistics flying around about overdose rates and child removals, foster parent Elizabeth Dumbaugh says it can be easy for people to lose sight of the real problem.
There's like a little person who just has no idea what's going on, and they're sort of in the middle of it all.
In their 2 years taking care of foster kids, Kate Dumbaugh says several came to them because of opioid abuse at home, and some were more exposed to their parents' addictions than others.
And we noticed in their behaviors that there was definitely evidence of trauma, and we had a 3- and 4-year-old who, for the first several months, anytime we were in the car and they saw a policeman, they would freak out because they'd been trained to look for the popo, and they would alert us, and they would duck.
But Dumbaugh stresses those kids' parents turn their lives around and have since maintained a positive relationship with her and Elizabeth. Brina Slater says she wishes the system had more parents like the Dumbaughs, whom she dubs foster moms extraordinaire. But fostering isn't for everybody, and even those interested might struggle to afford it. The average stipend's only about $420 a month per child. Slater says the circuit currently has about 400 kids in foster care and only 179 licensed foster homes.
We've had to actually have a lot of our children that are either placed in group homes to keep the siblings together or outside of our circuit, which means then you have to have a case manager driving to pick them up or, you know, foster parents having to drive to meet them. And that's not the environment we want for our children.
Which is why sometimes the coalition will waive the state requirement that limits foster homes to 5 children. Kate Dumbaugh says until just recently, they were caring for 7 kids at once.
There's such a need, and you hear the story, and you're like, sure, we'll put in bunk beds, we can make room.
Dumbaugh says seeing kids come out of their shells and make developmental gains during their time in her and Elizabeth's care is what makes fostering so rewarding.
I was get choked up when I talk about this, but I just feel like I'm on the front lines of love every day to see people who are just overcoming incredible odds.
The Dumbaughs say they're the lucky ones for getting the chance to help families heal. I'm Stephanie Colombini in Sarasota.
Amid a raging debate in Washington about student loan programs, Democratic U.S. Senator Bill Nelson of Florida held a meeting today in the state's capital city about legislation he's filed aimed at making it easier to pay off college debt. Nelson met with six young people who have student loans ranging from around $30,000 in total debt to more than $100,000. At the beginning of July, the federal government increased the interest rate on undergraduate loans from 3.75% to nearly 4.5%. Nelson's proposed a bill that would allow college graduates to more easily refinance their loans to a more affordable rate, while also lowering the cap on student loan interest rates to 4% for undergrads. According to Nelson, the average person who graduates with a four-year degree in Florida owes $23,000 in student loans. As a whole, Americans now owe $1.3 trillion in student debt. Outside of home loans, college debt is the largest financial burden on people, more than credit cards or auto loans. Still to come on Capitol Report, is Florida making strides or declines when it comes to taking care of sex trafficking victims?
3-4 years ago, we were still really wrapping our arms around what is this? Who are the kids and the adults that are victims of this in Florida? And we have really created an environment where the awareness is there.
As Florida's backlog of clemency cases keeps growing, a constitutional amendment to grant felons automatic rights restoration is moving ahead.
I've seen the number in the media of 10 or 11,000 pending clemency cases.
And at a time when public trust in government is reaching historic lows, Facebook is rolling out new ways for lawmakers to target its constituents.
It's not surprising that Facebook and others would think of a way to better connect people with their elected officials and to enhance civic engagement.
A new report on how Florida handles young human trafficking victims is receiving mixed reviews. We get that story from Sasha Cordner.
Florida continues to be third in the nation for human trafficking cases. Most involve young sex trafficking victims, and that number appears to be rising. In 2015, more than 260 were identified. That number grew by almost 100 last year. That's according to a report by the Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability. It's titled DCF and its lead agencies have not resolved issues related to serving commercially sexually exploited children. And Florida Department of Children and Family Secretary Mike Carroll is not sure of that name.
When reports go out like that and it says DCF and its lead agencies have not resolved issues related to serving commercially sexually exploited children, that's absolutely correct. We have not solved that issue. But I am much more positive than what that title conjures up. I really am.
The OPAGA report later states more than half the kids identified as sex trafficking victims may be referred to local services, but it's unclear how many use the services since there's no data, mainly because the cases don't originate in Florida's child welfare system. Still, Carroll thinks what's missing from the 23-page report is some context and perspective, adding Florida has made a lot of gains in its statewide anti-human trafficking efforts.
There's a big issue here about data. Mm-hmm. There's a big issue in here about our screening tool, how we deal with community kids. And all of those things have been issues that we struggle with. But when I think about 3 years ago, there wasn't even a real good understanding of what human trafficking was in this state, what the scale and scope of it was, what impacts it had. And so as we have worked with the community, I think public awareness is up. I think this topic is pervasive now in all of our agencies.
But the OPAGA report does point out that a new law supported by DCF will require the Child Welfare Agency to maintain data on all children classified as commercially sexually exploited, not just those in the foster care system. As in previous reports, OPAGA researchers also identified a number of issues with a human trafficking screening tool developed by DCF and the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice. That tool helps identify young human trafficking victims that investigators may come across in the field. But the report states there are issues with how DCF and DJJ screen for the kids and problems with the tool itself accurately identifying these victims. And Carroll says he sees this as a learning opportunity on things the agencies can be doing better.
I think for the first time we have a screening tool. Mm-hmm. Do we have issues with consistently implementing that tool? Yes. Do we have opportunities to go back and validate it or possibly streamline its use? Absolutely. But we have a tool that we never had before, and it's only been in place for a short period of time. So I looked at that as a positive, not a negative, and I looked at the need to validate that tool and go back and take what we've done and improve upon it as a natural way of doing business.
And DJJ Secretary Christy Daly says with several goals in mind, they have a lot of work to do.
What the report really represents is that, A, there has been progress made, but B, that really what we have outlined moving forward are those right, are the right things that we need to be focused on. And I think that's a great thing. I think that, you know, we still have a lot of work to do. And I think that the things that we have outlined as our goals are going to be what really gets us to a very comprehensive approach to this in Florida.
As both Daly and Carroll sit on the Attorney General's Statewide Council for Human Trafficking, Daly says she's especially glad for the work the council does and continues to do to bring more awareness to the issue. Meanwhile, as part of the report, OPAGA researchers did allow DCF and DJJ to give detailed responses to their findings. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kordner.
Tallahassee attorney Reggie Garcia knows more than a few things about Florida's clemency and restoration of rights process. He's been handling these kinds of cases for more than two decades and has met with clients in 30 state prisons. He's literally written the book on the subject. Actually, two books, with the more recent one called Second Chances, focusing on the fact that Florida has the nation's harshest laws when it comes to permanently denying certain things to all convicted felons. He notes under the state constitution is now written, only the clemency process can restore those things, which include
voting, serving on a jury, and seeking elected office. Specifically excludes firearm authority, which is a different type of clemency that's available. But on restoration of civil rights alone, everyone has to wait 5 years from the conclusion of prison or probation, whichever is last, unless they've committed one of 35 more and most serious felonies. Then there's a 7-year period and a requirement that there be a hearing for your restoration of civil rights to be done by the governor and cabinet at a quarterly meeting in Tallahassee.
And what rights restoration seems to concern Garcia's clients the most?
I would say half to two-thirds of the calls I get in emails, as important as voting is, are often by folks, many times business folks and professionals, who want their right to bear arms.
Of course, there are other questions as well. Garcia acknowledges the various requirements, timelines, and types of clemency are confusing. That's one more reason he decided to write a book about it.
There is a misperception that clemency is an appeal, that it's a motion, that you've got to go back to circuit court. It is none of those things. It is literally the executive power of the governor, who he or she can grant clemency at any time for any reason with the consent of two of the other members of the cabinet.
The seeming arbitrariness of that process has come under a barrage of criticism lately, including a scathing segment on comedian Samantha Bee's Full Frontal TV show.
I'm not a bad guy. I'm a good guy.
And I am very sorry.
Clemency is there's no standard. We can do whatever we want.
So I'm going to deny restoration of civil rights. But I congratulate you on how you've turned your life around. It's all denied.
Tough call, but at least it was arbitrary.
Garcia disagrees with that criticism. He says in his experience, the governor and cabinet look for reasons to grant clemency. But he says successful applicants need to have those reasons well documented and given to the clemency board in advance of the quarterly meeting.
The most important thing they're looking at is what was the crime, what was the conviction, how long ago was it, and have you reoffended? And if 10, 15, 20 years has passed and you've not reoffended, and there's a good amount of time to indicate that you've pivoted, if you will, and are now a good law-abiding citizen and taxpayer, I think that's what they like to see. And then particularly, why is restoration of civil rights, why is a full pardon, why is firearm authority important to you in your life right now?
But even if the governor and cabinet are looking for excuses to grant clemency, there remains a big problem, a problem that keeps growing: the actual number of cases awaiting action through Florida's clemency process.
I've seen the number in the media of 10 or 11,000 pending clemency cases, and I suspect most of those are restoration of civil rights cases that can be done administratively. That means if the governor and two members of the cabinet agree by just doing a review of the preliminary investigation, that then that does not require an in-person appearance at one of those quarterly hearings by the applicant.
But even if, and this is a very big if, the governor and cabinet were able to clear 100 clemency cases a month through administrative means, it would still take more than 8 years to dispose of a 10,000 case backlog. And that would assume no new cases would come up during those 8+ years. So now there's a constitutional amendment to change Florida's clemency process, proposed by the groups Floridians for a Fair Democracy, led by Desmond Mead, who's also president of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition.
The current variation would be automatic restoration of civil rights, except for murder and except for sexual offenses.
Back in April, the Florida Supreme Court okayed the ballot language for that amendment. Now Garcia says the real heavy lifting is underway.
The group trying to pass the automatic restoration amendment now has both the opportunity and the burden and the challenge to go get 766,000 signatures to get it on the ballot. And if that's the case, and I believe they have till February of next year to do that, then their amendment and any proposed constitutional amendment can only pass if the voters pass it by a supermajority of 60%.
And if that happens, it'll be good news for the more than 1.5 million Florida residents who can't vote or exercise other rights of citizens because there's a felony in their past. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, as lawmakers return to Washington to debate health care, they'll have new ways of communicating with voters back home through Facebook. But Kate Payne reports it's not yet clear how the social media giant's new tools could affect the political conversation.
Okay, so I'm going to log into my Facebook and pull up the Town Hall tab, which takes me to this long-running list of all of my elected officials, from city commissioner all the way to president of the United States. And let's look at U.S. Senator Marco Rubio's page, and we can look through the comment section. So what's different here is that some of the commenters have identified themselves as constituents through Facebook's Town Hall feature, and that just looks like a little icon next to their name.
It's not surprising that Facebook and others would think of a way to better connect people with their elected officials and to enhance civic engagement by using a communication tool that everyone's using.
University of South Florida political scientist Susan McManus says lawmakers are going to go where the people are. And for many, that's Facebook.
The question is always, will people really want to use it? Because you cannot make people vote. You cannot make people interact with their government.
Lately, U.S. Senator Marco Rubio has taken to broadcasting Facebook Live videos from his office. Here's a segment from one of his most recent talks on healthcare.
And we can disagree or agree on it. We don't have to hate each other over it. But what I can't tolerate, or what I really am bothered by, is when we can't have an honest debate because we're not debating the facts. We got to get back.
And voters worried about health care are taking the same tack, crowding into the senator's Tallahassee office and streaming it live on Facebook. Breast cancer, stroke, and aneurysm survivor Molly Goslin told her story to Rubio staffer Brian Mims.
And if it had not been for the ACA, I am telling you, Brian, I've told this or tried to tell Rubio, I would not be alive.
Now both sides have even more tools at their disposal, like the town hall feature, which lets voters track their representatives and upcoming election deadlines. And there's three new levers for lawmakers: constituent badges, insights, and district targeting.
Elected officials have the ability to pretty much identify who's their constituents or not. They also can get some feedback or share their thoughts on stories that are important to their district or to their region.
Aubrey Jewett is a political scientist at the University of Central Florida.
But now they can also gather feedback from their constituents through Facebook directly, and they can do polls and that sort of thing. And they can basically target and say, hey, you know, what do you guys, what's important to you all?
Jewett says, like it or not, social media is part of our politics.
Any candidate who is serious is going to get into social media in a big way. And probably not only that, if they're a big enough campaign and they're well-funded, you know, they're going to have a social media director. I
mean, the tools could elevate the opinions of a broader swath of voters and the issues that are important to them right now. But McManus says it's too early to know how Facebook comments will compare to other communication.
Two things really grab the attention of an elected official. It's a constituent who expresses themselves in their own words, whether that's a direct phone call or an email. Or a personal letter.
And this all depends on whether voters are open to their political and personal lives overlapping in new ways.
We do know from previous elections and studies that have been done that there are people who regard Facebook as entertainment and private. And the last thing they want is any kind of intrusion of politics into that space.
McManus says this all comes at a time when public trust in lawmakers is plummeting.
But according to the most recent surveys, just 20%, that's only one in five Americans, say that they trust government to do what's right for them. And that's the lowest it's ever been in history. So it's very troubling that people feel alienated from government.
But McManus says if Facebook can make voters feel like they're being heard, it could be part of the solution. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.